Hey, folks, as an avid reader, I am constantly seeking to learn new things. I like to learn. I like to feed my head. I like to gain insight into the books and characters that fascinate me and help me better appreciate the world around me. This is why I love The Great Courses Plus. It is a streaming learning service that offers in-depth, reliable information on just about anything that I'm interested in, from literature to history to science to psychology, even cooking or learning a new language. There is unlimited access to thousands of topics presented by renowned experts who are so passionate about what they teach. Best of all, it's user-friendly. You can watch or listen entirely on your own schedule from anywhere. Lately, I've been enjoying a course called Stories About Great Storytellers. You can imagine why. I like to talk to writers. I like to learn about writers, their lives, how they do the work, why they do the work, how the work came to be. Lately, I've been taking an in-depth look at Roald Dahl, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, James and the Giant Peach. You know that guy, right? I know that guy, but I didn't really know that guy until now. I explored some personal stories and watershed moments in his life that led him to writing the beloved works that made him famous. There is so much to discover on The Great Courses Plus. I love it. I know you're going to love it too. And to help you get started, they are offering my listeners a special limited time offer right now, a full month of unlimited access to their entire library for free. It's free. Sign up through my special URL right now and start enjoying your free month. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/other people. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/other PPL. thegreatcoursesplus.com/other PPL. You got it? Okay.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Big, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it's like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Just one person.
Hello, guys.
Just
how's it going? This is the Other People podcast, right. The Other People show. I'm Brad Listy, and I'm in Los Angeles, California. Rainy Los Angeles. I'm recording this in the midst of a winter rain storm. And I'm very pleased to have Duke Haney back on the program for a second time. It's my buddy Duke. I've known him for a long time. He lives here in town. He has been an integral part of the NervousBreakdown.com, my online culture magazine and literary community, for a decade, and at least a decade. I published his earlier essay collection called Subversia, and he is now celebrating the publication of an absolutely superb new essay collection called Death Valley Superstars, which is available now from Delancey Street Press. And for those of you who are not familiar with Duke, he worked in the movie business for most of his adult life as an actor and a screenwriter. He acted in a lot of Roger Corman movies. He wrote one of the Friday the 13th movies, I think Part 7, if I'm not mistaken. And he then turned his attention to literature, published a great novel called Banned for Life, the earlier essay collection Subversia, and now Death Valley Superstars. So, you know, Death Valley Superstars covers a lot of terrain, but the subtitle of the book is Occasionally Fatal Adventures in Filmland. So that tells you a little bit of something, a little bit of what this thing is dealing with. Duke loves the movies. He loves film history. He is a dogged researcher. He is incredibly well read on this stuff. He's seen basically every movie. He's one of those people. And there's simply not a better tour guide through this terrain, through old Hollywood, through peripheral Hollywood or underground Hollywood. The highest of the heights, you know, and the lowest of the lows. He kind of covers it. From Marilyn Monroe to Jim Morrison to Charles Manson. And beyond, and in places you wouldn't necessarily be familiar with or places you wouldn't necessarily expect. But it's all riveting, and it's just an excellent book. I think it's one of the best books of its kind. You know, a lot of people take a swing at this and try to write about this place, Los Angeles, that I've lived in for the better part of 20 years. And not many do it this well. So I'm thrilled for him. I think this is his best book. He just keeps getting better. Again, it is called Death Valley Superstars, Occasionally Fatal Adventures in film land. This is my conversation with Duke Haney.
I don't know. I've been this way since childhood, you know, since the second or third grade. I mean, I become interested in the subject and I just dive all the way in. You know, nobody has to guide me.
You're obsessive.
I just go right to that shelf in the library and I just pour over everything and just become like a sponge. So there's no real starting point. I mean, the starting point nowadays is always going to be the internet. You're going to look up what you can find about a person on the internet. From there, you try to figure out, you know, what more needs to be done. I mean, obviously there's going to be more because you're only going to find so much on the internet, which contrary to fallacy does not contain all of human knowledge.
Right.
For example, with Steve Cochran, I knew that he had been involved in a lot of litigation. And so that meant going down to the L.A. courthouse. And that's sort of what started the Sean Flynn piece, because I ran into this guy in the basement that knew him. And we just sort of met by accident, and he didn't even tell me that he was talking about Sean Flynn. I just sort of out of the air guessed what he was talking about.
And serendipity.
It was bizarre.
Yeah.
It was really strange.
But you're the person who would know who Sean Flynn is and would know the details. Like, really, though, of everybody I know, because I mean, and people listening, I would guess that 9 out of 10, if not more, wouldn't know who you're talking about. So who is Sean Flynn?
Oh, well, Sean Flynn was the only son of Errol Flynn, the great swashbuckler of the 30s and 40s. And Errol Flynn divorced Sean's mother. Or actually, I guess she left him, or they had a very combative relationship almost as soon as Sean was born, I think before Sean was born. And so Sean was raised in Florida away from Errol Flynn.
That's an easy father-son relationship. Nothing to do
it was. It was difficult, but not in the sense that they quarreled because he saw him so seldom. When they did see each other, you know, Errol would get hookers for Sean and that kind of thing. I mean, he was, you know.
As a loving father.
And so he died when Sean was 18, I think. He flew back to L.A. for the funeral and made a big impression on everybody who saw him there because his mother had been a movie star too. She's forgotten now, but
who was his mom?
Lily DeMita was her name. She was French.
Got it.
And she was kind of the Brigitte Bardot of the 20s and maybe early 30s. So, you know, he looked like both his parents. He was very tall and athletic, looking like his dad, and he was blonde like his mother. And essentially, to truncate the story, that led to him getting a movie contract. And he wasn't really interested in acting. He was an adventurer by nature, as was Errol. And he became a photojournalist, and he went to Vietnam to cover the war there and disappeared in Cambodia in 1970.
Never to be found.
His remains have never been found, no. No one, I mean, I was thinking about this the other day in the book. I was relating an American intelligence report that says he was taken prisoner by the Viet Cong and then later transferred to the Khmer Rouge. But even that isn't really known for certain. It isn't really known for certain who took him. There was another photographer, Dana Stone, who was taken with him. And there were several other journalists who disappeared in Cambodia in the same region at the same time. So they were killed somehow by their captors, but no one knows the circumstances. There's speculation that they were beheaded, that they were shot. There's a story that
whatever happened, it wasn't good.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were talking about themes before we got onto this. Like, what what are they? Like, you started with one.
Well, let me first just talk about how the book came about, because you came to me again and said, let's do a book like this, a whole book like this. And at the time you had an imprint, you know, TMB Books. And I thought, okay, because I wasn't getting anywhere with the novel. And so I began immediately to think about, you know, who I would write about and what I would write about. And I had some experiences, you know, for example, doing nude scenes in Roger Corman movies.
Because you were an actor for many years.
Yes, I was. Yes, thank you. And there's a piece in there about stalking Elizabeth McGovern.
You know what? I was sitting here when I got the book the other day and I reread that one. And because, you know, like I've read some of these a while ago,
yeah,
and it was just fun to revisit it and
thank you.
To think of you in that theater lobby, like, passing it down. Fucking creep.
I know. Well, I like to write things that are embarrassing to myself, because I think a lot of people don't do that.
Well, but I also think there's something charmingly honest about admitting to foibles and weaknesses. And we all have done it. Like, if you live long enough, you do embarrassing shit. Like, or at least stuff that's embarrassing in retrospect. I can think, like, I still, and I've talked about this before on this show, I can still torture myself over things I did in, like, high school.
Oh, I'm still doing that, too.
I have a hard time forgiving myself, and I'm just like, maybe I'm irreparably fucked. And then other times when I'm in, like, a more charitable mood, I'll be like, you know what, this applies to all of us. This is part of being human, I think. Maybe there are some people with a spotless record, but I don't, you know, I sort
no.
of doubt it.
No such thing.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I love when people are honest about that sort of thing. And, you know, you had a crush. And by the way, crushes, you know, whether you're a man or a woman, they can be sort of obsessive, right? That's the nature of it.
Well, I make myself out to be a little more obsessive in the piece than I was. I mean, it wasn't like my every thought was about this person. And I was, the crush I had, I really trace sort of the roots of it, I think, in the piece. I talk about sort of she was very like the kind of girls I went to high school with that would have nothing to do with me.
And you went to high school in Virginia?
Virginia, yeah. A lot of preppies.
Okay, but you were not.
I tried to be. I failed.
Okay.
Because they could all tell. I mean, they knew me anyway because I'd grown up there and they knew that I was from the wrong side of the tracks. And at a certain point, I began to figure out that maybe part of the reason people didn't like me was because I wasn't dressing the right way. So I tried very hard to get the preppy look right, because that was the big thing. And I could never quite afford the most expensive sweaters, you know, the most expensive shoes, the most expensive khakis. Khakis were crucial. They just all knew. I had the smell of dirt on me.
And now here you are wearing a John Deere baseball hat.
I've embraced my inner redneck. But not politically.
And you're from Charlottesville area?
Mm-hmm. I am from Charlottesville.
And that seems like a pretty affluent.
Very.
Right? It's a university town.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of rich people, like what professors, and then because I don't even know what there's no businesses in town, is there? It's the university.
The university. I'm trying to think of other businesses.
Maybe a few, but it's not like doesn't have like some industry in it.
Nothing comes to mind.
Just like beautiful rolling hills and like people with like acreage is what I'm picturing.
Blue Ridge Mountains in the background. The university does employ an awful lot of people. And there's a little bit of that, you know, townie versus student mentality there, or faculty mentality. And there's a lot of horse farms outside of the area. So you have a lot of very moneyed people living on the outskirts of Charlottesville. And so the public schools there were pretty good, because you have so many academics in town, and they would sit on the school board, or their spouses would sit on the school board. And so we did have a very exclusive private school there, St. Anne's Belfield. Like Sam Shepard and Jessica Lange's kids went there, I happen to know, because I'm still friends with my high school history teacher, and his wife worked at St. Anne's Belfield for a long time.
Okay.
But a lot of the wealthy people were, you know, not super wealthy people, but well-off people there would just, rather than send their kids to St. Anne's Belfield or some other prep school, they would just, you know, send their kids to public the high school because it was a good, you know, good school.
Good and free.
Well, that too.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have a lot of doctors, a lot of lawyers. There are a lot of people who go to the university and they breeze in and they say, oh, this is a lovely town. Oh, I think that when I finish school, I'll just stay here.
Right.
And so it was, I mean, I'm from a farming family. You know, my dad had a farm. My grandparents on both sides have farms. My
in that same area?
Mm-hmm. Right outside.
So how many generations does the Haney clan go back in that area?
I think to the 17th century. So we've been here a long time.
Yeah. From?
From England and Ireland, Scotland.
Okay.
I think. I haven't done one of those DNA tests.
Okay. Don't. They'll take your data. My parents.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's like one of the biggest data grabs ever. And like they will find out all of your genetic predispositions. Like I'm creeped out by it. I'm a strong advocate against.
Mm.
I'm very suspicious of anyone who's gathering data, and genetic data seems particularly rich in terms of their ability to exploit it.
Well, we're all a mix of everything anyway.
Right.
I mean, you know, we all come from Africa originally.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've seen some of those 60 Minutes type reports where they'll follow some person who's trying to look into their DNA and they'll say, you're from Cambodia. And the person will beam and say, oh, I knew it. And they'll say, but you're also Brazilian and you're also Antarctican.
Right.
And
right.
The person's jaw drops. They're like, I'm all of that.
Yeah, right. There's always a surprise or, you know, a surprise or two in anybody's past, I would imagine.
So this is turning into a Chinese box kind of conversation, which always happens with me.
I know. That's what I love about you.
I'm going to go back to the themes thing.
Yeah,
because
let's just
establish that.
Raised in Virginia from a farming family, experienced like class division with like the preppy girls.
Mm-hmm.
But then you moved off. You wanted to become an actor. Mm-hmm. You were a lover of film from a young age. This was like your escape, and not only from, you know, whatever difficulties or whatever boredom your childhood might have presented to you, but it was also your like you loved the culture. It was your way in.
Mm-hmm. Because I didn't have anything else. I mean, it was a terrible time for music.
What era was
the 70s?
Yeah,
I grew up in the 70s when you were born. And it was an awful time really for music unless you knew what you were doing, and I didn't have any guidance. I didn't have any older siblings to say, oh, that's Nowheresville, man, you got to listen to this,
right?
So I was bored really by pop music. I didn't like television. Nobody in my family really read. Movies were it. And fortunately, it was a great time for movies. But I didn't know that at first. I just went because it was there to do. And then gradually it dawned on me, my God, movies are great.
So what kind of movies were you seeing? Because the 70s, like, you know, I think were the last golden age, they say, of cinema when you had, you know, in American cinema, kind of director-driven films that would be very hard to make.
Mm-hmm.
Right? At least, I mean, that's the tale that gets told.
Yeah, I think. Well, I think it's true. You know, the studio system of the golden age of Hollywood had been slowly collapsing since the introduction of television, and the theaters were forced, the studios were forced to sell off their theater chains, which were a big source of revenue for them. There's a big anti-monopoly suit that the studios lost. And so by the early 60s, the old studio system was just in complete disarray. I mean, they were all selling off. I mean, that's how Century City came to be, because 20th Century Fox, you know, had to get rid of its backlot and all that. And MGM, I mean, there were like auctions. It was like, you know, own Elizabeth Taylor's frock for $5, you know, that kind of thing. So they didn't really know what the public wanted anymore. I mean, they were still trying to make these extravaganzas, which that was the 50 solution. We'll make really big movies for big screens and a lot of production value and in glorious color, and that will bring audiences in. And then that was no longer working. You know, big musicals like Paint Your Wagon, you know, were bombs. And so it was clear that there was a great generational divide, and the studios, the heads thought, well, if we can just somehow reach that youth audience. And so what seemed a natural solution to them was to hire young directors, youngish directors, in their late 20s and early 30s. And so you have that brief period in which studios are greenlighting, you know, movies that they would never have done before, and obviously have not done much since.
Well, like Easy Rider.
Well, that was a real watershed moment, I think, for the industry, because it was, I mean, that was sort of a real independent production, you know. And Peter Fonda was a Corman alum like I am, Roger Corman.
Well, so was Jack Nicholson.
Yes, and in fact, I think they knew each other from working for Roger. And I mean, Roger was, Jack Nicholson would say later, was practically the only guy in town that would give Jack Nicholson a job for a while there. And Roger, I was among the first, if not the first, to make biker movies. And so I guess Peter Fonda and or Dennis Hopper had this idea to kind of, it was basically on the road on motorcycles, basically, in the 60s, you know. Sal Paradise and Dean Moriarty, you know, riding around America. And you know, they filmed it in a very gonzo kind of way. I mean, although that's not a real commune that they visit and all that, you know, but the movie has kind of a gonzo feel about it. And of course, that movie was just a huge success.
Probably relatively cheap to make.
Yes, I think so. I think so.
So that seems like a good business model.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that to some extent, that's the business model that we're seeing repeated. Maybe more so like with Netflix or whatever. But it's like if you, and I think this is the horror film business model where it's like make these cheap films, relatively cheap, like $3 to $5 million films or whatever. And if one of them hits, it pays for everything and then some.
Well, I wish that the studios would go back to that model. But the model that they've embraced for a long time now is to make these huge special effects extravaganzas.
Because that's the only thing people want to go into the theater for. Everyone else is like, I'll just watch it on my phone.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, I hate to say it, but like everybody's just watching at home on Netflix, or I'll wait for it to come out on pay-per-view, and they have a big TV, and, you know, and I that bums me out because I don't go to the movies like I used to, and I used to always go. And I love the communal experience of being in a dark room and like this kind of theater of the imagination. And I don't know, it's always a better experience to see it in the theater.
Well, I did an interview recently where somebody commented, the interviewer commented on the first piece in the book in which I mean, the first paragraph in the book, I described this theater in my hometown, the Paramount Theater, which is a movie palace built in 1931. And this person asked me how much places like that contribute to the movie-going experience. Because this person lives in New Jersey, and he said the only place to see movies around here is a multiplex. It looks like a Sam's Club. And I said a great deal. I think that the venue contributes a great deal. It's the same with music.
Sure, yeah.
You remember, you know, I remember seeing, for example, Unwound, the band Unwound, down at The Smell. I mean, it was the perfect place to see Unwound, you know. And with music, I mean, the more dilapidated the venue, the better. You know, with movies, I think maybe it's the opposite. there's no grandeur about these places. And
whatever happened to this notion that architecture should inspire us? Now it's just like whatever's cheapest, you know, we can just throw it up in 6 months and start making money on it. You know, it's like you could say the same about like apartment complexes or whatever it is, but it's just, it's depressing.
Well, we're seeing that all over the place in L.A. right now. I mean, I write about that a few times in the book. I write about the construction boom and gentrification. It's really horrifying, actually. It's happened in my neighborhood in Echo Park. I don't understand people who want to live in places like that. But I guess these are people who just grown up with no sense of atmosphere at all. So they just move into these buildings with no atmosphere, no soul. You know, basically, it's a whole culture without soul. And I said in this interview that I don't think it's any accident that movies began to decline. The supremacy of film as an art form, if you will, began to decline basically when the multiplex took over.
But you were weaned on these golden age films.
Well, I got into those a little bit more. Well, 70s films, yes. I was weaned on those. We had a revival house in my hometown, and they would show classic films and that kind of thing. And I saw some of those. And the other thing about growing up when I did was that old movies were shown on late-night television, the Late Late Show. So sometimes I would watch an old movie on the Late Late Show or like on a Saturday afternoon of like a football game got rained out. They go, we're now going to show you The 7 Year Itch, which is probably how I saw that movie for the first time.
So what's the movie? What's the actor? What's the role that made you say to yourself, like, I want to do this. I want to be an actor.
Well, I know the moment that it occurred when that thought occurred to me. I write about this in a different book, but, I was watching They Shoot Horses, Don't They?, which is a movie from, I think, 1969 with Michael Sarrazin and Jane Fonda. It's a movie where Jane Fonda basically proved to the world that she could act.
Did you see the documentary about Jane Fonda?
No,
on HBO? It's excellent.
Really?
I loved it. And yeah. I loved her.
Yeah.
Like, she was very honest.
Yeah.
It was a warts and all. Like, a lot of times these things can kind of, there's a like a strong whiff of vanity.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like she was honest in the process and is just like, has lived a cool life in so many ways.
Yeah, you know, I would agree with that.
She's an interesting person and a good person. I like her. I mean, I don't know. I came away with some love for her after watching the doc.
No, there's a lot to admire about her. And one thing that I think tends to be forgotten about her is, I mean, in the 60s, man, she was sexy. I mean, I watched this movie, The Chase, with Marlon Brando. Robert Redford plays an escaped convict. Not very convincingly, because I don't think there are any convicts that ever looked like Robert Redford. And I forgot, so I can't remember, I think she plays his wife or girlfriend or something like that, but I was like I was floored. I couldn't, you know.
Yeah, she's beautiful.
But it's more than that, you know. Sexiness is not just a thing of beauty. I mean, that's the literal-minded 21st century way of looking at everything. Everything is, you know, very, it's like, well, beauty, of course, you know.
Right. But also like a really like vibrant intelligence. And I don't know, I'm using like I have all this context now because of this documentary and I sort of know how unhappy she was in the early days and how much like she was struggling. And then she gets into like activism and I don't know. But I think all of that contributes to the effect. There's a lot going on. It's more like, you know, more than meets the eye.
Yeah, I think... I think that what I'm talking about has a lot to do with carriage and with voice and manner, you know.
Yeah.
And
so it was they. What was it?
They shoot horses, don't they? Which is a movie about the Great Depression. It's about a dance marathon, and it's very bleak.
Sounds like a reality show.
Well, it kind of was a bit like that.
Yeah.
It was these people dance for you know, 72 hours or a week or something, you know, with no sleep practically. And it was basically the last man standing was the whole thing of it. And it's based on a novel. I can't think of the name of the guy who wrote the novel. I read one that he wrote about Hollywood a couple of years ago, and I can't even think of his name right now. He was from Georgia originally. It wasn't a terribly good novel. If I had grown up 10 years later, I probably would have been a goth. I mean, I was like always depressed, you know, and angry. I was screaming all the time at my parents. Fuck you.
So what was it? But who was the performance in that got you in this movie?
It was all of it.
It was all okay.
But I think she was great in the movie, but it was just the milieu of it. You know, because I could just identify with that heavy thing. And I was sitting there watching it, and I thought, you know, I could do that. I could be like that. And then I thought, you know, you couldn't be an actor. Are you crazy? And then I got up and I went into the bathroom and I like stared at myself in the medicine cabinet mirror for like, you know, like a good 10 minutes. I was turning this way and that way. And I was like, well, you know, I think if I age the right way, you know,
How old were you?
15.
15.
I was like, because if I put on some weight and I got a haircut, I was thinking about it purely in physical terms because it just seemed to me that, you know, I would be hired or not hired on that basis, not on whether I could act. I knew I could act because I had done it. You know, I had already done some plays. I mean, I talk in the book about doing. I mean, I wrote a play in the fifth grade. I starred in my own play a couple of times, actually.
It's very like Wes Anderson, right?
Yeah, actually, there was a touch of that to it. I never thought about that before, but yeah, there was a bit of that.
And then, when did you get the bug? You go to New York. You're like, if I'm going to be an actor, I got to go to New York.
Yeah. Well, originally, I couldn't decide if I would move to L.A. or New York, So I actually made a quick trip to L.A. and I was like, nope, not for me. It just was a bad trip.
Where'd you go?
Well, I didn't know where the hell to go. I was basically fucking this 27-year-old woman, and she got a job in California as a newspaper woman in some small weekly near Santa Cruz.
And what, you were like, what, 18?
I was 18. And we were doing a community theater production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown together. She was Lucy. I was Charlie Brown. I was just starting to do a little bit of that because I you know, while I was in high school, we didn't have a theater department anyway, but even if we had, I was like, I wouldn't have gone near it. I did not want to be a theater kid, you know? But once I was out, it was like, okay, now I can start to, you know, get my feet wet.
So was it like, did you have an awareness of like Stella Adler and Method?
Yeah, I did.
You did?
Actually. Yeah. Okay. Cause so again, I went to the library and I was like pulling books. I was walking around with an Uta Hagen book.
Okay.
Respect for Acting.
So this has always been there with you.
Well, you mean the research thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. And like it was always like that.
But that's good though. You're an autodidact. Like you, and you have some good instincts. Like at least you were on the right trail. Like you weren't, you know, studying with some acting teacher in like Tallahassee. You
know? No. I thought I needed to get into a program, and I did get into the Neighborhood Playhouse, which is a very famous theater was originally run by Sanford Meisner. And actually when I went there to audition, Sanford Meisner walked through the room. He had cancer of the throat, so his larynx was removed. So he spoke with one of those voice things, you know.
My God.
He's an acting teacher.
Was
with
this
that.
In New York?
Yeah, in New York. So I auditioned for the Neighborhood Playhouse, I guess just after I moved to New York, and I was accepted. But I couldn't go because it was a full-time program, and they forbade you from working in the evenings.
Why?
Because they said it's a conservatory. They said you need to devote your full...
Will they have scholarships or anything?
Well, I wasn't offered one.
Yeah.
But I, of course... You know, it was a great pat on the back to be admitted. I mean, I knew that, you know, I knew where everybody had studied, where everybody had gone to school. And I was like, oh, James Caan or Robert Duvall went to the Neighborhood Playhouse, you know?
Oh, they did. Okay.
Yeah,
I don't know all this stuff.
Yeah.
See, there's something sort of Zelig-like about you when it comes to the movie business because, you're in it for so long.
Yeah.
And you were, you know, both coasts.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a strong familiarity with the New York scene, but also you've been in LA for a long time. So
too long.
Yeah. but you've had at least like brushes with so many famous actors and people in the movie business over the years, like among whom Elizabeth McGovern. You were always like, what, not even 6 degrees of separation. And that's really the way it is in any, I don't know, maybe not any business, but certainly in the entertainment business, it's actually smaller and more insular than I think maybe people on the outside might imagine.
Yeah. Like, well, I say in the book, if you have worked as an actor in New York or LA, that the fabled 6 degrees of separation are usually one or none. And so I did know a lot of people who knew her. You know, my manager, John, knew an actor named Todd who knew her, and he had met her once at a party, and I just kept saying, could you introduce me to her?
But what was it like? Try to draw a parallel. Like, Elizabeth McGovern at that time was similar to...
I don't think there's anybody nowadays that... I don't really follow actors anymore. I used to know everything about everybody.
Yeah, me too. I don't know anything.
I don't care about anybody anymore, you know.
Is that a function of age or has it gotten worse?
It's gotten worse.
Is that, but isn't
But everyone really... always blames everything on age. So, you know, let people blame it on age. I don't care.
Well, no, but I worry about that myself. Like, I'm always like, is it the stuff or is it me? And I just tweeted this. I was like, I think it's me. It's got to be me. It can't be the stuff. People have been making art forever. Like, actors are... There's good actors.
Well, that's true. No, there are good actors. I'm not saying there aren't good actors. I think the X factor is gone, I think, in them. You know, there used to be some mystery or mystique, some charisma.
Your book evokes that, though. I feel like you're capped... Because, I mean, the subject matter of your book is... there's nothing... Like, the actors and actresses that are featured are from, you know, decades past. So
yeah.
Back when that was still in effect.
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, in effect for you and me and a lot of people. But
I write about a number of people who, you know, like Mark Frechette was not really an actor. Sean Flynn was not really an actor.
Well, and it's like this nice mix. Because one of the things I wanted to ask you is that, you know, what I appreciate is when you cover... these sort of like quote unquote peripheral characters, people of great talent who might never have hit or just people who functioned, I think, on the periphery, but did interesting work or there was a tragic story to tell or whatever it is. But you're also covering Jim Morrison. Mm-hmm. There's also Hugh Hefner, Marilyn Monroe. So like, it's not like you're just sticking to one side of the aisle, but do you like, just to get back to our initial conversation about theme, like, is there a thematic unity that you feel binds all of these figures?
Well, I do. Now we finally go back to the one of the original Chinese boxes. I identified it very late in the book. I realized that almost everybody that I write about in the book was a rebel, whether quietly or violently. So I would define. I could go by through it case by case, but I mean, even someone like Elizabeth Taylor, I met her when I was a teenager. So that's why I wrote this little piece about, that was the first one I actually wrote for the book before I knew there was going to be a book. But I mean, even she, I think, was a rebel, in the sense that, the affairs that she had would have destroyed a career, before hers. And she was very defiant. She was like, nope, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. I'm going to marry who I want to marry. If I don't want to be with them anymore, I'm going to divorce them. I don't care what you think. And, Marilyn Monroe pushed the envelope in terms of sexuality.
That was one of the things, cause I read that one too. You know, just after getting the book this week, it's like, who was it? Was it, Billy Wilder who said Marilyn Monroe is the meanest?
Yeah, he did say that.
He said, she's the meanest person
I ever met.
Yeah. She's so fascinating. I mean, it's kind of like the most obvious thing in the world to say, because everyone seems to be fascinated with Marilyn Monroe, but there's just so much there. And, like, what a heartbreaker on so many levels.
Yeah, she's, well, one comment, I didn't put this into the piece, but one comment that I consistently read about her was people remarked on her, there was a, her duality. It was a very profound, there was a profound duality about her. An example, the photographer Milton Green, who was her business partner, that was the guy that she started Marilyn Monroe Productions. You know, I write in the book about this whole secret escape to Connecticut, you know, and she was hidden in the trunk of a car and all that stuff. That was engineered by Milton Green to get her away from 20th Century Fox. And she went to New York and said, I'm starting my own production company. I don't like the way that I'm being treated. I don't like the way I'm being marketed. He said that, you know, when he first met her, he was just blown away by how angelic she seemed. He had met a lot of celebrities, a lot of stars, but she was like just unbelievably sweet. And he said, but later I found out she could be completely the opposite.
That's freaky.
And a lot of people remarked about that schism. There was a kind of schism in her, like two different people in her. I think there were many more than two, but
she had a very rough childhood.
She did. She exaggerated it a little bit, but
how so? What was that?
Well, for example,
because she grew up in foster care, right?
She did, but it was a little. What happened was her mother had a best friend. They were like these wild women of the 20s, you know, like flappers, I guess. And they both worked for Consolidated Film Industries. I think they both worked for Consolidated. They were both in the film industry, and they were both enamored of the movies. And the mother was institutionalized, and so her friend Grace Goddard became Marilyn's legal guardian. When Marilyn's mother had her, she placed her almost immediately in foster care. But that was not uncommon in those days for people to basically have a kid, and if they couldn't care for them, they would see them on weekends basically, and they would. So Marilyn was living with a couple out in I think it was Hawthorne, California. She was
the home of SpaceX.
Oh, is that? I didn't know that.
That's where they build those rockets and stuff. But, you know, the other thing that impressed itself upon me when I was reading that, and this kind of speaks to what you were talking about with regard to your younger self, like age 15, looking at yourself in the mirror, is the degree to which Marilyn Monroe created herself.
Mm-hmm.
Visually, her name,
mm-hmm.
there's an intensity there. And a specificity and a, like artistry that like I didn't quite put together. Like she constructed that character,
mm-hmm.
you know, that version of herself
mm-hmm.
in a really meticulous way. Like,
yeah.
And she had work done, like, you know, not that that matters all that much, but mm-hmm. I mean, her face, that makeup, her, like, I think you talk about how she always looked at the negatives or the contact sheets.
Yeah, every shot on every contact sheet.
So she
would go over it with a loop, and she would, you know, later on when she had power, she would destroy the negatives of shots that she didn't like.
Okay. Well, cause that makes so much sense to me in retrospect, because what I always note about Marilyn Monroe is that she never took a bad photograph. And part of it is that she's extraordinarily photogenic,
mm-hmm.
but the other part of it would seem to be that she exercised a lot of control over what got out into the public domain, which just seems smart to me.
That's true. But, if you, you know, Bert Stern, who did the last sitting with her, he saved, contact sheets, and I think the negatives too of the pictures that she destroyed. She would actually take a pen and she would stick the pen through the picture or the negative to put holes in it so it couldn't be used, and then she would exit out with and I've seen some of the things that she rejected, and it's really odd because you'll see two frames right next to each other, and she's cleared one, but she hasn't cleared the other, and the difference is slight. But she hated it so much.
It's like me with my phone. I'm just like, ugh. You can kind of see two chins. I got to get rid of this one.
Oh, I'm a big one for that. But she was very photogenic, partly because she was such a great student of the camera. I mean, when she began modeling, she would go back to the photographers after the session, and she would ask to look at the contact sheets. This started very early with her, and she would go over it, and she would talk to the photographer about, you know, why doesn't what's you know, what doesn't work here? Why doesn't this shot work? And he said, because you're not doing this, and you're not, you know, you're not turning your head here, and you have to point your toes more to get that, you know. And so she just had that stuff down.
That's what I mean. Most people don't realize that.
Mm.
Like, she put a lot of work into knowing
it.
How to pose, and like knowing like what, you know, and I think a lot of actors these days do this, like what's their best lighting and angles and what's their best side. I mean, I think some of that stuff has been around for a long time, but I don't know, just the degree of attention to detail.
Well, she did a lot of it on her own, though. That, I think that's one thing that makes her distinct, because, you know, Marlene Dietrich, for example, you know, von Sternberg was the person who figured out how to, Joseph von Sternberg figured out how to light her, you know, because they used to do that with big stars. They would, you know, it was almost like a manual, you know, like a set of instructions about how to photograph this person, you know, so that when a DP was assigned, you know, they were told, you know, you have to, for Gable, you have to do this to like minimize the ears and blah, 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 blah.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
And so there were ways to light Dietrich so that, you know, the cheekbones were emphasized and, you know, it made the eyes look a certain way, and she knew it. So later on, after, you know, she didn't have the studio there to kind of guide people, she would just go on the set and go, okay, I need a light here. I need one here. I need one here. And, you know, Monroe had that kind
did,
of.
Did you have that when you were an actor? Did you
no,
get to the, did
God,
you get to
no.
the point where you could, but I mean, did you know, did you have a sense of,
oh yeah, you do learn it. I mean,
but you don't have the authority to be like, hey, like,
no.
Yeah.
But it's something that you have to learn. I mean, in the old days, you know, they brought you in, they did tests with you, you know, and I think that you became aware of that stuff pretty quickly. You know, like, this is what you have to do, and this is what you should not do in order to look good at the camera. You know, with me, I had to look at myself and just sort of come to my own conclusions. I mean, nobody was talking to me much.
Well, you know, but I think, like, just especially if you're somebody who achieves a certain level of celebrity, and especially in this day and age with social media and camera phones and all of it, you know, I think most people have just given up on trying to control their public image, like literally, like the images that make their way into the public domain, photos taken, selfies and everything else. But I remember reading an article, it's either an interview or an article, featuring Kristen Wiig, the Saturday Night Live mm-hmm. actor. I love her. Mm-hmm. She's yeah. so great. You know, such a, like,
I haven't seen her movies, but I used to like her on the show.
Oh, she's like, I don't think there's been anybody as good as her on that show, maybe ever. Like, so, like, she could really do the, you know, she was a great actor, I think, mm-hmm. or is a great actor.
Yeah.
So, but I was reading, and the part that I'm recalling is that in the interview, I guess, like, they pointed out that she doesn't like to do selfies with fans.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you go to her Google Images, like, you're not going to find the litany of photos that you typically would with a celebrity of mm-hmm. her stature, because she's very reticent and very private. And part of me is like, I think that's smart.
Yeah.
Like, she's, like, very nice, but she's like, yeah, I don't want to take the photo because you're going to put it up online. And, like, I think if I were an actor, I might be the same way, you know? Otherwise, it's just, or maybe that's caring too much. Maybe that's too precious by half and you should just let it go. Take a selfie.
I don't know. I think maybe going forward, a few people will begin to realize that you know, one way maybe to enhance your value is to retain some mystery.
I was just going to say, because like, nothing kills it faster than being on a billion Instagram feeds.
Yeah. I'm not curious about anybody anymore. I mean, that's not really true, but you know, people are out there just showing everything, telling you everything. I mean, actually they don't tell you everything. I can think of a good example of this. There's a woman I know, I suspect she's recently broken up with her boyfriend, but she has not made any official announcement online. And she recently posted a photograph of herself undergoing a medical procedure. So she posted that, but she hasn't posted anything about her breakup. It's interesting.
What kind of medical procedure?
She was getting stitches.
Oh, okay. I was thinking,
No, it was, she wasn't having her tubes tied or anything.
I immediately went gynecological in my mind.
No, nothing quite that bad. Not that that's bad, but I mean, you know,
not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, not that personal, but nevertheless, it's, you know, there's blood and, you know, there's a gash and you see gloved hands stitching it up, you know.
Right.
So I don't know that I would put something like that out there. I don't know.
I think there's a lot to be gained from being judicious if you're a celebrity. And yet I think the pressure to be constantly out there is probably pretty intense, kind of similar to book people. I mean, it's differences of scale, but it's the same thing. Like, do I go on social media? Do I tweet 100 times a day? Do I create an Instagram feed for my tour and all that stuff? And publishers are telling you to do it and agents are telling you to do it. And I don't know, man.
It's a horrible thing. I told myself at various points that I was not going to get out there and, you know, push this book. I was like, you know, when a book, just fuck it. When the book comes out, I don't give a shit if anybody buys it or not. I hate shilling. I don't like shilling for others either. I mean, I'll do it if I feel like it. I don't like that quid pro quo thing.
Well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to shill for you. and I mean, with the utmost sincerity, people listening who have an interest in film and the history of film and have an interest in Hollywood, and not just the Hollywood of the imagination or like the Hollywood of whatever you want to call it, high achievement or elite Hollywood, you know, like this book is an outstanding tour. Like Los Angeles too. I mean, there's a lot of different aspects. It's prismatic. It's not just one thing, but, that whole milieu, and it's so good. And I feel like even though you're not necessarily inclined to go out and like stump for it and do a lot of the shilling, I feel like it's the kind of book that's going to spread by word of mouth.
I hope so.
I think it will. I think people who, I mean, I don't know how many people out there who knows, you never know how, like what's the market size for any book, but, my instinct is that people are going to go, oh, holy shit, you should read this. It's really good.
Well, I put, you know, as you said at the beginning, it's true. I pour myself into what I do. I mean, we were talking earlier about actors, and I was disparaging of today's crop. And it's because, really, there was an expression that you used once to me, not that you coined it, but you remember you talked about giving blood, and that was the kind of actor I was. I gave blood, and those are the kind of actors I like. I like actors who give, you know, and that's one thing that makes Marilyn Monroe stand out. It's that she, you don't see it, because it was this whole light, frothy can things, but she was giving blood. It was a very difficult thing for her to get up and do what she did.
You know who she reminds me of, or who I kind of compare her in my head to? And maybe I'm drawing on something I've read. Maybe something you wrote, but Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, God, yeah.
Like, she, to me, as a comedic creation, an actor, like the entire visual presentation, how comprehensive... Mm-hmm. But also how indelible of a cultural imprint she made, just like Chaplin, you know, it's like iconic. You did the mustache and the hat and the two big shoes or whatever. I'm sure there's a proper name for them, but you know,
the tramp.
Yeah. That creation. And then whatever we call, I don't know, is there a name for what Marilyn Monroe became, the starlet or the dumb blonde?
Yeah. Basically that was the character that, you know, she became synonymous with. Yeah, I would say at this point that she has supplanted Chaplin. I mean, there are people now who don't know who Chaplin is, which I just find it just blows my mind.
Yeah.
And you say something like that and people are like, well, it's before my time. Well, it's before my fucking time too. You know, I mean, I grew up knowing who, you know, all these people were, and they were from way before my time. I mean, I could name all the presidents in order at the age of 7, you know. I mean, it was like a party trick.
Well, you're also from Charlottesville. You got to know that shit in Virginia, right?
Well, that was a big part of it, really, I think, growing up in Virginia. because, you know, there were a lot of Civil War battles there. There were Revolutionary War battles there. Virginia used to refer to itself as the mother of presidents because so many early presidents came from Virginia. And I grew up very close to the residences of three of them, Madison, Monroe, and Jefferson. Monticello was, you know, right up the hill. I could just look up and see it.
No shit.
I saw it all. When I first became aware of him, I was always looking for it. Like, where is Monticello?
I've been to Monticello a couple times.
What do you think?
You know, I think my feelings are much more complicated now.
Yeah, because of the whole slavery thing.
Yeah, I didn't know. Like, when I went, I was, like, in junior high.
Yeah.
On, like, a field trip.
Yeah.
And then again, when I was just out of college and hiking the Appalachian Trail.
Uh-huh.
And I took a break and met some friends in Maryland. And I guess I wanted to go see Monticello. I've always been, like, sort of interested in history and politics. Mm-hmm. And I love history. And I love being in places that really make you feel it, especially, you know, the further west you live, I think, the harder it is to grasp maybe a real palpable sense of history in this country. Or maybe that's not right, but you know what I'm saying? Like, you go to New York and the buildings feel a little bit older, and in LA, everything feels so evergreen. And in Virginia, DC, you get a deeper sense of roots.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to go back to Monticello because it had impressed me when I was there. It's worth seeing. I think it's definitely, my views of Jefferson are a lot more complicated than they used to be.
Yeah. Mine too.
But, he was, you know, you can argue with a lot about him, but you can't argue that he's a very bright guy.
Mm-hmm.
and kind of a polymath. He could do a lot. It wasn't
Yeah.
Like, it was architecture and inventions and, you know, that house is kind of like there's like a Willy Wonka-ish quality to it somehow, you know, in my memory anyway.
Well, he was a true product of the Enlightenment. I mean, all those, many of the founding fathers were. And that Jefferson was a polymath is probably, you know, one of the reasons I aspired to be something of a Renaissance man myself, you know. Because I remember looking him up in the encyclopedia. You know, for those of you born in the year 2000, every American family pretty much had a home encyclopedia.
I had the World Book.
Yeah, my grandparents had that. I liked that because it had color pictures. I had Collier's Encyclopedia, which only had black and white pictures.
Okay.
But it did have color plates in the Renaissance section.
Okay.
So I became interested in the Renaissance as a child, partly because they had these reproductions of paintings by Da Vinci and Botticelli and so on, you know. So when I looked up Jefferson, it would say Thomas Jefferson was a U.S. president, diplomat, farmer, and it was this long list. And I think I even went to my mom. I was like, you know, well, how could, you know, but he was just a president. How could he do all those other things? And she said, but people can do more than one thing. And I said, they can.
Well, Ben Franklin, too.
He's another great example.
I don't want to get too nostalgic, but it is hard to look back and not be like, well, I think like people were smarter back then or something. And then you read I always say the old Civil War letters. You know, if you watch that like Ken Burns documentary and like those narrations of Civil War letters, like people just wrote so beautifully. You're just like, my God, like what happened to like our literate society?
I know. Some 18-year-old soldier I take my leave of you as I am swept away by the winds.
But I mean, like, it can get me choked up. You're like, well, this is some beautiful writing. I don't know, man. It's probably bullshit. I'm sure. I mean, there's a lot of emails these days that could probably, if you read them aloud with the right musical accompaniment, would do the same thing.
Not mine.
Yeah.
I have a one typo per sentence minimum from all of my emails.
That surprises me because you're so meticulous in the work that you do.
Like, I know.
Nobody, for people listening, like Duke is, like, you're slow on prose, which you say in the book.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
You know, you work very slowly and methodically and just painstakingly. How many drafts do each of your essays go through?
How long on average
does one piece take? Do you ballpark it?
the longest ones, the one about Mark Frechette took me about 4 months, I guess. That's 17,000 words. And the one about Chris Jones, probably about the same length of time. But I also had a very, I was so broke at the time. I had a roommate who was putting me through roommate hell.
Doing what?
Oh, Jesus Christ. It was a whole thing. I'm not supposed to have a roommate, and I've already been through an eviction drama with my, my landlords. And so I went through a series of people, you know, living there, and I would tell every one of them, the landlords come around on Tuesday morning, you have to be out of here, you know, by 9 o'clock and, you know, in the morning. And they're all like, oh, okay. And then of course they aren't, you know, they just walk outside, like, you know, the landlord's standing right there. And then I get this hammering on my door. Who was that person? You know? So that was one aspect of it. Just having guests over, and you know,
the roommate having guests over,
and, you know,
you're trying to write
at late hours. Yeah.
Oh God.
And, that kind of thing. And, and I was writing, trying to write and just dealing with all that, you know, and I was also holding a really awful job at the time. So
doing what?
I was, raising funds that specifically, I think at the time I started that. Well, I started that piece, the Chris Jones piece. I started many times. And I thought I had made a proper start of it. And then I ended up just throwing it all away and starting from scratch, I think toward the end of 2016. During the election, I was on the phone actually, raising money for Democratic candidates and for the Clinton campaign.
Well, that's a good thing to have done, right?
Well, maybe not if you're a Bernie Sanders person, but,
were you Bernie?
I was not, for one reason only, and that was because I thought it was really critical for Democrats to consolidate behind Hillary Clinton. So,
well, once she got the nomination.
No, but in the California primary, I was really apprehensive that if she didn't win decisively, that there would be a lot of contention about what had happened, which ended up happening anyway. Yeah. I actually saw Bernie on the street here. On primary day.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Like randomly?
Yeah.
Where was it?
It was outside a, like a gelato shop on Sunset Boulevard. I was actually aboard a city bus. I was going to my horrible job and, there was a traffic jam and I thought, because I'd been seeing online that day, like Bernie Sanders was seen feeding the ducks in Echo Park Lake and that kind of thing.
Just and by himself.
Yeah, no, tracking corrals wherever he went, you know. And I thought, I bet you it's Bernie Sanders. And then we got a little bit closer and there was like a line of limousines that were sort of just stopped in the middle of the street. Thank you very much, sir.
Limousines for Bernie.
Yeah, well, it was, I don't know who was in the other, but it was like a caravan of limos and with flashing lights, and he was on the sidewalk, and there was a great crowd of tattooed, pierced people taking pictures. And
yeah, now that you say this, like, I'm trying to look back, because I always say, like, you know, I liked Bernie a lot in the beginning, and I liked him on policy. Like, a lot of the things that he was saying policy-wise.
I want everything that he talks about.
Right.
But as a Hillary Clinton supporter said to me on the phone, she said, I want what Bernie is talking about. We all want what Bernie is talking about, but how are we going to get it?
Yeah. But I felt like it was important for somebody to just be unapologetic and bold and, like, start from there. And then we can negotiate backwards instead of being like, you know, we can use this policy from the Heritage Foundation that, you know, Mitt Romney used. It's like, then you're negotiating with yourself. I think there was something about having him say it without apology that appealed. But now that you're talking about the California primary, which in 2016 that's late in the game. It's changing now, schedule-wise. California's going to be more towards the front, I think, in 2020. But by the time you get to California in 2016, it was like, okay, guys, it's time for us to start. Like, the math is done. He can't win. Let's
rally
around.
That was my thinking about it. But I voted for Hillary, and I could never have foreseen myself being a Hillary supporter a few years ago, because I was very critical of Bill Clinton's administration. Because of its foreign policy, I lived in the former Yugoslavia, and I saw firsthand.
All right, you spent a lot of years there as an actor, a lot of time.
I spent
there.
A year there. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I actually more than a year. If I look at the first movie I did there,
you're
I did
famous there.
I was famous there.
Yeah,
I wouldn't be now, of course.
You never know. There could be some. There could be some diehards.
I don't think so. But so I was not a fan of air foreign policy there, But I realized later that I was confusing her with him. I was just sort of putting them together like people do.
Listen, the Clintons are complicated. I always argue this. They're not. It's like if any deep dive into them, if you don't walk away with some pretty heavy mixed feelings, maybe you could say this about any politician. But man, Bill Clinton especially, is tricky. He's complicated.
Yeah, but he's interesting for that reason. And I mean, he's the kind of person I could write about. I mean, you were asking about themes, and you know, I didn't write about people because of their artistry for the most part. Marilyn Monroe is an exception. I do think she's a great artist. I think so. But I just wrote about people who have really interesting stories.
I think by doing that. Like, I think by following your instincts and by knowing as much as you know and by having spent time on the inside and the outside, you capture this place and the movie business better than just about anything I've ever read.
Well, thank you.
Like, in all of its facets. Because the thing is what we see is all that surface-level glitz, obviously. We see what they want us to see. You know, it's the prepackaged junket interviews and all that bullshit.
Mm.
But there's a very, I guess, well-documented, to some extent, underbelly. There's another side of the tracks in Hollywood, and there is a cost to all of it, even great success. I mean, Marilyn Monroe's a fine example, you know.
Yeah.
And then before I let you go,
yeah.
Jim Morrison,
mm.
You know, that piece and all that went into it. And I think we share, I mean, and we can
talk
about
it. Well, I had a seance for Jim Morrison. No, I know we have to wind things up here.
No,
so,
but I mean,
yeah.
No, I want to talk to you about it
because
we share a love of the Doors. You love the Doors, right? Or you like them?
Yeah, I like the Doors. I mean, I talk about my evolution with the Doors.
I feel like there's something, they evoke Los Angeles for
yes,
me.
Yes, that I mentioned that.
Yeah.
I talk about how it really, when I moved to LA was when I could really, I could kind of understood the Doors a bit better somehow.
Right, right. It makes a lot, the Doors make a lot of sense once you're here. And
they
like
do.
You're in Venice Beach or, you know, whatever it is. But
even the sound of it though, it makes a little more sense here somehow. I don't know how to articulate that.
So what was the genesis of the idea? You're going to hold a seance. I remember, like, because I remember back when you were like talking.
Well, you're
to
supposed
me.
To be there.
Yeah, right.
You bailed.
I can't remember what was going on.
Well, it was a whole thing. It was in the middle of the summer. I mean, I actually booked okay. So here's the thing. And this gets into sort of, you know, how I was picking subject matter and all that stuff. I mean, there's some pieces I decided right away. I'm going to write about this guy and this guy and this guy because. I just knew they had really fascinating stories, like Sean Flynn's story. Not many people knew about it. Mark Frischetta's Zabriskie Point, not many people know about that. Not many people know about Christopher Jones, which is a really fascinating story. I think that may be the best piece in the book, actually. And then I was going to write about some personal experiences. I just thought the whole topic of L.A. and the film business was just a very large umbrella. I could fit almost anything under it, you know, so I could write about Lee Harvey Oswald from a film perspective, which I do. And I could, you know, I could put it into this book, you know? So a lot of the other pieces I didn't have, I just thought I'll decide as I go forward, you know, I'll see sort of what comes to me. I had wanted to write about this Playmate of the Month named Victoria Vetri, who was kind of a B-movie star in the late 60s or early 70s. And she was shot her husband and went to prison. And I thought that would be an interesting story, you know. And I tried to get in touch with her, and I couldn't get in touch with her. And I'd done all this research into Playboy history, and I thought, well, I'll just write about Hugh Hefner, because I think I have sort of an angle on that now, you know, from all my reading. And so Jim Morrison, you know, I would never have thought about writing about him, except that I had seen online this really interesting photograph taken of him when he was a film student at UCLA. He's a little overweight. He had short hair. It's before Jim Morrison.
Yeah, he's like pudgy and sort of like baby-faced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a great photo otherwise. I don't know who took it, but it was, you know, it has kind of it almost looks art directed. It's sort of blues, and there's a beer bottle kind of sitting on this.
That was the filter. That was the Instagram.
Was it?
No.
Well, they did have filters back then. It's just that you didn't press a button and voila, instant filter. And they were film students after all those people. So
sure.
They all knew about cameras and stuff like that. So I just on a whim put it on Facebook, and I was never popular on Facebook. So, you know, I mean, I could go on Facebook and say, I'm dying. And I, you know,
2 likes.
Exactly. Let me know when it's over. And then other people could just go on Facebook and just say, you know, like a single word, you know, they could write baby food and they get like 200 likes.
Yeah. But you know what, man, I'd rather have it be the former instead of the latter. Like as much as it's nice to get that dopamine, it's got to fuck with you and give you.
Oh no, the whole thing, the whole experience. If we got into that, it's a rabbit hole. We'll
never come out.
No. It is a rabbit hole. And to talk about it is one also, but, and I'm undergoing a lot of it right now because I'm out there trying to, you know, push the book, oh my God, at the end of a day, I just feel like I've been skinned alive.
I think you should do is like get some copies of the book. Think about people in the culture. I feel like there are people in the movie business who would love your book. People like, and like editors at like magazines like Esquire and Vanity Fair, like, why are they not publishing your stuff?
Well, I don't know. The most mysterious thing happened to me at one point. I don't even know if I should get into this with you, but somebody from a huge agency wrote to me very mysteriously after the Chris Jones piece went alive. I don't know if there's any relationship to that. And they said they wrote to me, and I misread the email. I thought they were talking about representation, and then I didn't when I looked closer, it was the acquisitions department, and they were asking me about representation, and I said, I don't have any representation, and then I never heard back. And I actually went to a former agent of mine, and I
what, to acquire the rights to like make like
I don't know what I don't I mean I thought the timing of it was really curious, because that piece had just gone up in the nervous breakdown a few days before. I just got this. I think, in fact, they wrote to you. You forwarded the message.
Maybe that's
to me.
What it was. Okay, because I'm sort of like recalling.
And they wrote to you, in fact, and they said, I'm trying to get in touch with. And they had done research on me. They had to it because they knew all my various names, Dr. or Duke or Daryl Haney.
Or Darrell.
Well, it was meant to be pronounced Daryl, but spelled interestingly.
Oh, okay.
No,
okay.
It wasn't meant to be Darrell. But people kept mispronouncing it. They go, Darrell Haney.
Because you wait, like, just so for people listening, Duke used to like spell his name like D, what was it?
D-A-R-E-L. And then I misspelled my last name, H-A-E-N-Y. I thought it was more interesting.
It is visually, at least.
And people kept saying, Darrell Haney. So finally, I was like, fuck it, I'm going back to the original. But yes, this woman said, I'm trying to get in touch with him. And then I got the message, and I just woken up, and I got all excited and was like, oh my God, somebody from like the biggest agency in the world wants to sign me. You know, and I wrote back, I don't have a representative. And then like a second later, I read the email and I thought, I just wrote the worst thing I could have written. It's the worst thing. It's like saying nobody cares and nobody should care. So go away. Do not investigate further. Feel free to steal from me because nobody will protect me. I, you know, And I never heard from them again. I went to a former agent and I said, would you write to this person at blah, blah, blah agency and ask them, try to find out what they were trying to contact me about. And I never heard from him back from him either.
Who knows, man? Somebody could have been just like an intern or someone who it's like checking.
But there was some, they were poking around into something. I don't know what it was.
So Jim Morrison, though, have the seance, you go to.
Well, the idea was just that I put this picture on Facebook and I remember it was like 40 likes. And that it never happened to me before.
It's electrifying.
It kind of was, you know. I mean, I could literally go on there and go, I have just published a 200,000 word novel. It has won the Pulitzer Prize, and I get like one like, you know. And I thought, wow, people seem to really respond to Jim Morrison. And I like Jim Morrison. I'd seen that documentary made
so
about
good.
Him, Tom DiCillo's documentary. I went, it was an acting class with Tom DiCillo.
Oh, really?
Frank Rosaro.
Was it People Are Strange or whatever, When You're Strange?
Yeah, When You're Strange, yeah.
The old footage.
That is the most extraordinary thing about that documentary.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, I showed it to a friend of mine. He's very snotty. He's like, well, it's very conventional, you know. And I said, I know, but look, I mean, they restored that footage. I mean, look at how pristine that footage is.
It's like he's right there, you know?
When he first walks out of that car at the beginning of the movie, it's mind blowing.
Yeah, I know.
You're like, I was like, when I first saw it, I was like, oh, fuck this. It's going to be some fucking guy walking around in a wig.
Yeah, right? Like a recreation.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh my God, it's actually him.
Right.
You know, and it's just beautiful footage.
Yeah.
And so much that the whole documentary is basically restored footage. I mean, they don't do any talking head interviews. You know,
that's
it's just
great.
Johnny Depp narrating his affected voice.
Right.
That was really, you know, the thing that made me, you know, more of a fan. I mean, it was just seeing all that footage. I was like, my God, that guy really had it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't care what anybody says. I know a lot of people hate him and, you know, fuck you all. Because, he was 27 when he died. I mean, nobody. Yeah.
Who's fully formed at that age?
That's exactly what I write in the book. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I write in the book.
I'm trying to think if you sent me the link or if I stumbled into it, you know, just on some internet excursion of my own. But there is a YouTube video where his father and sister are interviewed.
Yes.
After his death.
Yes.
And it's touching.
Yeah.
Because his dad has, like, who's like this military man. He's like an admiral in the Navy or something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he was an admiral.
Yeah. So, like, this kind of like hard ass military guy, you can see why Jim Morrison might have had issues, you know, how there might have been some tension between the two.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, you know, after Jim died, his dad, like, in his grief, sort of like has all this pride in, like, the accomplishments of the Doors and, like, made some concessions. Like, he achieved, you know, he achieved big things, basically. It's my recollection of it. Right? Or is he still sort of a hard ass about it?
No, well, he's dead now.
What, his dad?
Yeah,
I know, but I mean, in this video, like, am I remembering it correctly?
Oh, yes, you are. I think, in fact, that may have been done for the Tom DiCillo doc, for the extras.
Oh, okay.
I think maybe it was done for that.
God, man, it kind of ripped my heart out, because it just made it real. It was like, oh, man, this was somebody's son.
He looks like he's tearing up a little bit.
Yeah.
And
why do I feel like I never had prior to that, I had never thought of Jim Morrison as like a guy with parents.
You know? Oh, I think very much about his parents, because I think that had so much to do with how he turned out. I think it was difficult for him. I think, to be the kind of person he was growing up in that kind of family. I think it was a Navy family. I think it was pretty rigid.
Yeah.
I think that accounts for a lot of his rebellion.
Sure.
I just basically, to go back to the piece, I just was thinking, you know, how can I write about him? Because maybe I should write about him if people like him this much. And then I just had this thought that maybe I could rent his motel room and
at the Alta Cienega,
at the Alta Cienega motel and hold a seance. And at first it was kind of a flippant idea. And then I began to think, no, I should really go for it. I should get a psychic medium, you know, one who's, you know,
skilled.
Well, allegedly, but somebody that others have vouched for. And so so much of the piece became about that. It became about trying to find a psychic. And I just found that part of it really interesting, because you think you throw a rock at any tree and, you know, five, you know, psychics would fall out of it, along with, you know, 10 astrologers and and so on. But it proved to be surprisingly difficult to find somebody. And then ultimately, yeah, I did go down and
don't tell us the end.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to read the piece to find out how it turns out. Duke, it's great to see you in person, even though we both live in this, you know, in this city, we don't see each other enough. And congratulations on this book. It's outstanding. I love the way that it turned out, and I'm interested to see, what is it, a novel that you're working on?
I'm going to start a novel. I've done a little bit of, investigatory kind of, you know, like I've tried to start it, but I had to put it aside to finish this book.
And you think you're ever going to write about Hollywood again in nonfiction form like this?
Probably not in nonfiction form. I think I've kind of had my say with this. You know, it would depend, you know, who knows, maybe one day there'll be a Death Valley Superstars 2, you know.
The sequel's never as good as the original.
I agree with you. But yeah, I think I'd like to just go back to fiction. And I did have an epiphany about a new novel, so I'd like to get to that. And that will have a little bit to do with Hollywood.
Excellent. Well, congratulations.
Well, thank you, Brad.
All right. That's Duke Haney. His new essay collection is called Death Valley Superstars. It is available from Delancey Street Press. Death Valley Superstars, Duke Haney. If you want to find him on Facebook, you can do that. I believe he is on Goodreads. You can also track him down on Twitter. His handle over there is @Subversia. The book, one more time, is called Death Valley Superstars. Go get your copy immediately. Thank you to The Great Courses Plus for sponsoring the show today. Don't forget to go get your free month of courses at thegreatcoursesplus.com/otherppl. Thanks to Kill Rock Stars and the band Stereo Total, as always, for the theme song music. Thank you to Tiger in My Tank for the interstitial music. If you would like to throw a few bucks in the hat and support the show, you can do that at patreon.com/otherpplpod. That makes a difference. It's appreciated. If you would like to write to me, let me know what you think. You can do that by emailing me at letters@otherppl.com. Don't forget that there is an official Other People app, and it's free. It's a free app, the Other People app. It's free. Go get it wherever you get your apps. So it was good to talk to Duke. It's great to see him having this publication success. I saw this book be born, so I think I have a little extra excitement about it. I saw it come to be over the past 6 years. It's like a slow materializing process, and I'm proud of him. This is a really good book. It's hard to write really good books. It takes a while. But, you know, Duke puts in the time. Next week on the program, I'm going to start Next week on the program, I have Brad Phillips. He's got a new book out called Essays and Fictions. We discuss whether or not it is essays or fictions. He says it's fiction. Brad Phillips and I will be discussing all of that and more next week. It's out right now, that book, Essays and Fictions from Tyrant Books. I believe he's my first guest named Brad. Two Brads. Aww.